Hi, this is Amy.
And this is Andrew. And in this episode, AADL talks to radical lawyer Buck Davis.
Davis talks about his life as an unrepentant radical lawyer, the importance of Judge Damon J. Keith's famous Keith decision, and reflects on the personalities of former White Panther friends and clients.
I came to Detroit dodging the draft in 1968. I was stunned to find that the war was still going on when I got out of law school. It was pretty clear to me my mother hadn't raised any soldiers. I was supposed to go over to Harvard Business School from the law school. My first wife was teaching over there by then, and I was going to take my MBA, but a funny thing happened on the way to Wall Street. I tried to stack degrees. My draft board said no. So it was either join the Army, go to jail, or join VISTO, the Volunteers in Service to America. I chose VISTA. We canceled our plans to get married. And unbeknownst to me, VISTA had a secret policy of isolating you as much as possible from your prior support network. So every place I said I wanted to go were the ones that they X'd off. And never having been in a state which didn't border the Atlantic Ocean except Pennsylvania, they sent me to Chicago on August 28, 1968, in the middle of the Democratic Convention, put me up in the downtown Y, one block from where Humphrey was staying at the Conrad Hilton. Ralph Abernathy and the Poor People's Campaign were also staying at the Y. I had been having an idyllic summer in Cambridge and was not politically motivated at all, except by my desire to avoid the draft. We landed in Chicago, and the demonstrations had been going on for two or three days. I had been unaware of them. I saw all these cops along the streets on the way down to the Y. Got into the Y, thought I'd go out and see what it was like. Saw some smoke, went up to where it was. Turned out to be tear gas. The hippies running the other way grabbed me and took me with them to keep me from getting run over by the cops, who were rapidly charging. Then got me to a fountain where I washed the tear gas out of my face. Once I figured out what was going on, I decided I was going to overthrow the government. So I went back to the Y, tore up a T-shirt, tried my glasses on, took a couple of hits of speed, and went back out to Grant Park and stayed there for 3 days. And then I was too scared to stay in Chicago. And at that point, Detroit had the only discount flights between Boston and Detroit. Wednesday night at 12 o'clock, you call up Mohawk Airlines, get a $49 round trip so my fiancé could come out and visit me. I had my first meal in Detroit at the Burger King and the Greyhound station. I spent my first night in Detroit in the barracks at the downtown YMCA. I rapidly got to use a four-bedroom brick house, which the Methodists had abandoned to the Mexicans. And for $60 a month, less than the utilities, I lived like a king, making $48 a week without a car the year after the rebellion in Detroit.
That's a way better answer than I was expecting. That's a great story.
Well, when did you decide to start pursuing cases for people who were being harassed or discriminated against?
Well, that was it. That was my political conversion. Back then, the war on poverty really was a war on poverty rather than a war on the poor. And I was assigned to what was known as the Kennedy-esque component of the legal services program, community legal counsel. And we had our offices in a downtown office building right next door to Carl Levin, who's now our senator, and Art Tarnow, who's a federal judge. And my first boss was the son of socialists, and we were not supposed to do individual cases. We were supposed to do group representation. So I started off representing the United Tenants for Collective Action, which were organizing rent strikes around the city of Detroit. It was a wonderful time. Revolution was in the air. They didn't want 67 to happen again. They would throw money at you. You could write a grant for anything. They would give it to you. You could do anything you wanted to. In January of 69, the Jeffries Action Committee was formed by the welfare rights organization called West Side Mothers and one branch of the Detroit Division of the Black Panther Party. And we took public housing out on rent strike. Pretty much ended up taking every project out. Ran for about 3 years. We never lost one. You know, we made them form the Board of Tenant Affairs and all of that sort of stuff. In the meantime, I got to go know more and more of these leftist lawyers like Cockrell and Ravitz and Riosti, and people are a whole lot more interesting than the people I grew up with in Richmond, Virginia. So after my year of visitor, when I was safely past the draft, I applied for a fellowship and got it. It was called the Reginald Heber Smith Community Lawyer Fellowship, which paid a magnificent sum of $10,000 and allowed me to get married. And my wife came to Detroit. I determined that, you know, this is where I was going to have my fellowship. And because my money came from Washington, they couldn't control me. I was a poster boy for why they got rid of legal services. I opened up the National Lawyers Guild office in Detroit in January of 1970 and represented or organized the representation of everybody who got busted for either anti-war or civil rights activity for the next 2 years. Then the fellowship ran out, and by that time I was a father, and I had to go out into private practice. I went with the hardest core left law firm that I could. I continued my representation, political representation, because I had determined that because of my male and white skin privilege had gotten me out of the draft, I would defend anybody who opposed the war for free until it was over, which I did until the fall of Saigon in May of 75. Then my partner said, "Davis, you're our only trial lawyer. You got to go to work." So I started suing people and graduated into civil rights law, suing the government. And that's pretty much how I've lived since that time.
Did you know did you know John Sinclair and some of these folks before you were involved in the case?
I had some vague awareness of his, I had some vague awareness of his existence, and I had some vague awareness of the bombings that were going on in Detroit in the fall of 68 when I first got here. But by that time, the White Panthers had moved to Ann Arbor. John was in prison, and I was working with the hardcore urban poor. And I knew that Chuck Ravitz, one of my mentors, had been representing Sinclair for a long time and was still working on the case, but I didn't know any of them. And then, as you saw in that letter, you know, I've been representing the Black Panthers for a year, and I was sick of them. He had been representing the White Panthers for 4 or 5 years. He was sick of them. So in early August, we decided to trade for a year. And 2 weeks later, Plamondon got busted in the Upper Peninsula, and they walked in and said, "We're going to go get Kunstler and Wineglass." And I said, "Okay, well, I'll do it." Figuring that it would never work, they did, and off we went.
Did it create difficulties for you personally or professionally having to defend people who were hated by a large segment of the population and the establishment itself?
I pretty never represented anybody but that. What can I say?
And has it made things difficult for you?
Well, that, you know, my law firm only has one rule. We don't beat up big, little guys for big guys. And politically, you know, I was learning. I had what would be called a classic liberal arts education growing up and going to school through college in the segregated South. And but I was very naive, very unprepared for any of this stuff. I'd crammed an enormous amount of knowledge in my head. I don't know if you remember the old GE College Bowl, but I was responsible when my college was on for all literature ever written plus current events. So I had this enormous amount of knowledge, which meant absolutely nothing to me. And I remember standing by the elevator in the Penobscot building in Detroit about 2 months into it. And my boss, Ron Riosti, came up to me and he said, "Davis, no wonder nothing makes sense to you. You're thinking about it from the point of view of capitalism. Think about it from the point of view of socialism." Well, it was like Saul on the road to Damascus. The scales fell away from my eyes, and I spent the next 10 years rereading world history, literature, political science from a Marxist, socialist, whatever you want to call it, perspective. And as the staff attorney in the Guild office, I had to represent every political tendency, which meant that I read every one of their papers trying to figure out who I thought was right and who I thought was wrong. That's just what I've done. I mean, it was having to face the draft was the best thing that ever happened to me. Otherwise, I would have been miserable somewhere on the East Coast, probably in New York.
We, of course, would like to talk to you about the big trial, the U.S. versus John Sinclair, which then became United States versus – yeah, which is confusing, I think, for a lot of people who maybe have a vague understanding of what happened. And I'm wondering if you would mind giving us just a brief overview.
Talking about the facts, or are you talking about the law or the politics?
At this point, just the facts.
Okay. There was a crazy guy by the name of David Valor who lived in Detroit in the fall of 1968. He was some, you know, petty bourgeois, suburban, whatever, and a disaffected counterculturalist, seriously into dope and LSD. And somehow or another, he got his hand on a lot of dynamite. So there were 8 bombings in Detroit that year. And I've since I wrote that paper, I've had somebody write me an anecdote that I didn't know. He was walking down the street near all the hippie communes near Wayne State University when some of the other revolutionaries were sitting on their front porch. And the 13th Precinct is right down the road. And Nick, I can't use his name, a guy was sitting there, a guy who's known to be a hardcore lefty. And Valor pulls up his shirt and says he's got all this dynamite in his whatever and says, "Won't you come on down to the 13th Precinct with me? And I'm going to blow up one of the cars in the parking lot." The guy says, "No." Valor says, "What would Che Guevara think about you refusing to blow up a police car?" And the guy says back, "What would Che Guevara think of you blowing up an empty police car?" That'll give you some idea what it was like. One of the bombings, there was a CIA recruiting office in Ann Arbor, and somebody threw a couple of sticks of dynamite, I think smashed the window and threw the sticks of dynamite inside. And that lay fallow for some time, but by that time, John had gone to prison, and Valor became crazier and crazier, and finally he turned himself in to the editor of the Detroit News, and he confessed all these bombings, and he, whatever, but they kept pressing him, and he ultimately said that his confederate in these bombings was Jack Forrest, and that he had met with Sinclair, and that Sinclair had said he didn't want any dynamite himself, but he might take some for somebody else. And somehow or another, Valor claimed that Plamondon told him that he had done the CIA bombing, and claimed that Sinclair had been in the same room with him and gazed at him meaningfully and shook his head yes after the CIA bombing. And that became a White Panther CIA bombing conspiracy case. When Plamondon heard about it, he was a fugitive. He became a fugitive because he had cases all over the country. I mean, he was a walking felony. But he couldn't stand it, the underground life, because it's too austere. And so he came back, even though he was the first FBI top 10 revolutionary who was white. And he got busted, theoretically, for throwing a beer can out of a van on his way to a hiding place in the Upper Peninsula. The case started. They got concerned Wineglass. That was what we had to defend. Damon Keith got the case, civil rights hero and legend. And I was the local counsel and represented Forrest. We filed all these motions. By that time, there was a growing awareness of the government's wiretap program. And as we were doing throughout the Radical Lawyers Network around the country at that time, we filed a motion for disclosure of electronic surveillance. And they came back and said, yeah, we got some. So then once they admitted they had it, Keith had everybody brief whether it was legal or not. And about a month later, in January of 71, Keith ruled that it was illegal and ordered them to turn it over to us. And they said no. And we thought that what they were going to do was say, hey, judge, tell you what, let's have the trial, and then after the trial's over, listen to the tapes, and if you think that anything on the tapes would have affected the trial, okay, but we say it doesn't, and therefore we shouldn't have to turn this over. And Keith said, no, you got to turn it over. And they said, you don't understand, Judge. We're never going to turn it over before or after the trial, and they never have. It went. He said, okay, Mr. Kunstler, make your motion. Kunstler moved to dismiss. The government begged for 5 days to get a stay from the Court of Appeals. Keith gave it to him. The government picked this case. They're the ones that decided they were going to make this the test case. The issue was coming up through other judges in other Black Panther case in L.A. Judge Ferguson had ruled their way, but that was post-conviction, which meant all the transcripts, all the stuff, and then the whole regular appeal process. They didn't want to wait. They wanted it validated, and they picked this case.
Why?
Why did they pick this case?
We have no idea. Nobody knows.
Do you have a best guess?
One, I think they knew that the wiretaps didn't have anything to do with the trial. We think the wiretaps, we thought for a long time that the wiretaps were a NSA intercept. Because when Plamondon first went underground, he went to Algeria, and he was there with Eldridge Cleaver. And they're calling back to the United States, and we think that the NSA, which is now known, but at that point even Congress didn't know that the NSA existed. And so we think it was an NSA intercept from Algeria to Black Panther Party headquarters in Oakland. And that's the reason that we think that it really didn't have anything to do with the case. So one, they knew that it was clean and couldn't, the waters couldn't be muddied. And two, it was pre-trial. And three, it was this obscure band of hippies
Michigan that nobody, not many people had ever heard of. And the ones that had, including us in Detroit, thought, you know, just a bunch of, you know, white poseurs. Although they turned out to be more substantial than, you know, we thought. So maybe they thought they would have an easier ride because these guys wouldn't have to support infrastructure, network, whatever, whatever, whatever. And, you know, they could have gotten a lot of judges and practically any judge, you know, down on that bench at that time, they could have won their motion. Or at least the judge wouldn't have made them turn it over. It was just everything had to fall exactly right for it to happen, but that's what happened.
Why do you think they wanted it decided at that moment? Why did they decide it was time to test out the wiretap waters? Is it because they were escalating their wiretapping program and they knew they were going to get caught up in it soon?
Oh, by that time, in 1970, early 71, there were major anti-war conspiracies and Black Panther conspiracies all over the country. Connecticut, Chicago, San Francisco. And then there were the Weather Underground. The Weathermen had split off in the fall of 69 from SDS, and they were bombing everything all over the country. And otherwise, finding out how many people you can sleep with in you know, a short period of time living in one house. You know, so they had some big, you know, they had a lot of fish in the fire, you know, that they were frying. And the courts were going to make a decision, and they wanted the right established, you know, before the fact that they had illegally wiretapped everybody. And it was all a part, I mean, it was... The wiretapping was just the most benign part of the COINTEL program. I mean, you know, assassinations, provocateurs, agents, whatever. I mean, so this is the gentler, kindler COINTEL pro as opposed to, you know, the White Panthers got the easy ride, you know. So I think that they really felt like they had to have it, and that if they waited until it percolated all the way through, if it lost, then they really had a problem.
So it went to the Supreme Court, and they upheld it unanimously. And what is your view of the impact of it politically and legally, of the Keith decision?
The White Panthers saved the movement straight up. They dropped every anti-war Black Panther, Weatherman conspiracy in the country, because every one of them was tainted. And so I'm telling you, that case, people don't realize it, but they were getting ready to kick our ass. And, you know, we snuck up on them in the mid to early 60s with the civil rights, the anti-war, and the youth and the culture, and then the women, and then the environment, and all of that. But it's not like the slaveholders weren't gathering for their revenge, and they were gonna dismantle the left, and gave us 8 years until Reagan. Then they started on the program which they are still embarked upon.
So you were a young lawyer, and you got to work very closely with people like Bill Kunstler and Arthur Kanoi and Len Weinglass. And what did you learn from them as, what were you, 27, 28, something like that at the time?
27. It was like having as much fun as you can have all day, every day. Get high, go to work, fuck the government, and then go home and get high again. And in the meantime, have a few drinks and find somebody to sleep with. What can I tell you? And I've tried to keep it up as much as possible.
Compared to everything else, compared to the other pretrial motions, this is a small thing, but I read that one of the things that came up was the issue of the age of the jury, the potential jury, and also the length of hair. Did you have long hair at the time? Were you sort of a...
Fairly long. I mean, not. I was never... My hair was never as long as the White Panthers, but my hair was longer than anybody I had ever known before I got to Detroit. And by a couple of years later, it was fairly long.
Judge Keith dismissed both the claim that, you know, there needed to be younger jurors and that long hair, you know, more accurately represented the counterculture. I mean, what did you think about all of that? Were those things that you felt were significant?
Well, at the time, the slogan, "Don't trust anybody over 30s, was damn near true, you know. Right now, I'd go the other way. Not trust anybody under 30, a bunch of Hitler youth. Anyway, but, yeah, I mean, we believe that our clients with their lifestyle just weren't going to go down with the average federal juror. But making age a class was the Old Age Anti-Discrimination Act hadn't yet been passed, so... If you look at it as the opening shot of creating age as a suspect category, you know, for purposes of discrimination, it was a nice little opening shot. Second, in state court, we did the Wayne County jury challenge where anybody on welfare, anybody with an afro, and it would be right there on the questionnaires. And so when we did the, I think it was the New Bethel case where a couple of guys got, a couple of cops got shot outside a church, Aretha Franklin's father's church, when the Republic of New Africa was having a convention there, and some cops got too close and somebody shot them. And Cockle and Ravitch did that case. And Neil Bush and I, Neil was also a part of the defense team on this case, we worked on the Wayne County jury challenge, and we blew that system wide open and permanently changed the complexion, no pun intended, of jurors in Wayne County. And it was the beginning of a wave of jury challenges. So we didn't win those, but they weren't unrelated to the overall legal and political struggle.
You mentioned before that the tapes that were being discussed in this case and the tapes of the later wiretaps of the White Panther Party, the contents of those have never been released. And I'm confused about how the government can keep things classified that they obtained illegally. How does that work?
Ask Bradley Manning. How do they lock him up for stuff that he downloads off the internet? And whatever. I mean, there's nothing honest, okay? There's nothing honest about the system. It will protect itself, and it will protect itself in any way that it has to protect itself. Classic Marxist analysis is imperialism rules by bribery and corruption at home and by terror and violence abroad. Lucky us. We live in the bribery and corruption division. They don't kill that many white lawyers, you know? But the idea that there's anything honest about the courts, about the Congress, about the executives, that's just not true. And therefore, you get close enough to beating them, they'll change the rules or they'll ignore the rules. And what are you going to do? You don't have an army. And therefore, that's the political answer to that question. You can't litigate your way to liberation. You can't legislate your way to liberation. That's just not going to happen. You either build a big enough movement to where the army won't shoot you, or you aren't going to make a revolution, as we're getting to watch a lot of little experiments in that particular process right now. And it's different in each country and whatever, but one thing's for sure. They're ready. We're never going to sneak up on them again. And if we can't organize it from the inside and outside, like in Wisconsin, where the cops and the firefighters wouldn't go for it, you know, that's how you win. And so legally, if anyone has ever tried to get the tapes that were involved in the underlying case, that is the CIA bombing conspiracy case. I don't know who would have done it. And once we won that case, you know, we didn't win that case until January of 72, 73. And we just had a lot to do. And, you know, making our own history wasn't a part of it. Second, with regard to the second wiretap, I've got those. I know what they say. But I can't reveal them because they're under a protective order. I've got the legal memoranda written, and I'm working with reporters and some declassification experts in Washington. But again, you know, there's a lot to be done. You know, that's still not at the top of the list. And so maybe one day when we liberate the Pentagon or the FBI or the CIA or the NSA, we'll get it. You know, up until then, if I got to choose, then it's not going to be number one.
I'm curious about what you thought of the White Panthers and the 10-point system and everything at the time. And you had said earlier that, you know, at first that they were viewed as sort of just a side group, a fringe group not to worry about. And then you realized that they had more of an impact, or they were more significant ultimately. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, one, I am now and always have been culturally ignorant. Okay. I remember my friends, they reminded me of it. I've forgotten about it. But I remember when I tried to read the entire encyclopedia from in the 7th and 8th grades. And music never meant much to me, one way or the other. You know, 60s rock and roll, fraternity house, you know, Animal House fraternity boy, and that sort of stuff when I was in college. And got knocked out primarily by Dylan in 63, but I didn't keep growing and keep following it, you know, in any real sense. And growing up in the South when I did, there wasn't much blues, and we looked down on the hillbillies, you know, and the mountain music and the roots music and that sort of stuff. And race music was, you know, even though, you know, Doug Clark and his famous Hot Nuts used to come to my college and play for, you know, fraternity parties. And so did the Isley Brothers, whatever. But that just never was where I was, okay? So that's one thing. And a lot of the cultural stuff that John and all of them were immersed in was relatively foreign to me. Second, when I said I decided to overthrow the government, I wasn't kidding. And in my view, the revolutionary forces weren't going to come from these people. They were going to come from minorities and workers. And, you know, my roots were in the city. And that's where I was building up my coterie of comrades, the Motor City Labor League, the Control Conflict and Change Book Club, you know, big organizations that were making big differences. Ended up elected Ravitz, the first Marxist judge. And, you know, we dropped out. I dropped out when, you know, it was pretty clear to me that the only thing Kenny Cockle wanted to do was be mayor of Detroit. And it was pretty clear to me that that wasn't what I signed up for. John was in prison. I didn't know him. He's pretty much an asshole. Was then, is now, even though he's mellowed a lot. But, I mean, John is an extremely self-centered, difficult person. And he's writing letters from prison, you know, telling people to storm the barricades. He's trying to keep 40 people alive without a job and put out a free newspaper every week, you know, living in two houses on Hill Street. And he wants more and more and more. The real hero was his brother, David Sinclair. Oh, man's man, or I assume that's too macho to say these days. But between David and Lenny, they're the ones. They're the ones that raised the money. They're the ones that organized. the organize the benefits that kept the organization running, you know, whatever. I mean, Pun's in prison, you know, John's gone. And so the people who did this were not John. David and I got to be very good friends. And I would go with him to visit John in prison, and I would come up and stay at the White Panther House, and it was a lot of fun. And I have particularly fond memories of certain of the Panther ladies. But David was harder core on the political front than John was. And I was always struggling with David, you know, about, hey, man, you know, real Marxism, real revolution, whatever. And I didn't understand it. I don't know. On the other hand, he was closer to me than the others. So I have since come to appreciate, to some extent, the depth and the innovative and bold and progressive nature, and have discarded some of my doctrinaire, hardcore Marxist-Leninist view of youth culture and that sort of stuff. And I consider them to be significant. But at the time, I had taken up this job, and I had to finish it. And I didn't finish it until the summer of 73 when, that's right. The decision was in 60. It was in 72, and 73 was Pun's last bust up in Cadillac when we went up and stole the town, and snuck one past them, and got out of Dodge before they figured out. You know, slept with the judge's girlfriend, and all of that. Got out of Dodge before they could figure out what happened. You know, so I mean, it was a 4-year ride for me, and I spent a lot of time. It cost me my first marriage. You know, my wife finally took my daughter and moved. And, you know, I paid a lot.
In his book, he describes you as being pretty fed up with him by the last time he got busted. Pretty upset. Had you just had it by then?
Well, you know, after 18 felonies, what are you going to say? You know, I mean, he was a wonderful guy to be around and to party with, but he was uncontrollable. And, you know, I was moving in a more serious political direction and moving toward being a cadre in a democratic centralist organization, which is kind of like the opposite of the White Panthers. So there was tension within my law firm and tension within my political organization. But on the other hand, you see that Sheila Cockrell, or Sheila Murphy, supposedly a member of what is called the LDC, the Labor Defense Coalition, you know, that's the reason she was on the bill at the 10 for 2 concert, because of the influence that I had with, you know, the White Panthers, and that Chuck Ravitz had, you know, from representing John all those years. But there's definitely, by the end, the Cadillac case, the marijuana extortion case, it was a frame-up, and we convinced the judge of that, and he gave his opinion. We waived the jury in that case because we couldn't find a fair jury in Cadillac. They knew that, and we had a fair judge, and when he gave his opinion, he says, I've been in love with the state police for 20 years, but this case has convinced me they should not be involved in politics, and, you know, so we get him convicted of a 20-year felony, and he gives him probation. A guy that has 18 felonies. You know, that was a great escape. I knew them all. I liked them all. I didn't understand quite how talented they were. You know, that they really were remarkable, mm-hmm. and a remarkable group of individuals who have gone on in their own way to do remarkable things. And so I'd have to say that I was a little bit blind to the opportunities that I had. And I was a little bit arrogant and quite as kept. I was a little bit older, except maybe than John. I can't tell you, aside from Pun and John and David and Lenny and Linda Ross, that I had close relationships with them. And I wasn't here in the early part. I didn't get here until 68. So all the really neat stuff that went down between 65 and 67 with the East Town and Grandy Ballroom and all of that stuff, I wasn't here for that. I probably wouldn't have had anything to do with it if I had been, but so what? But on the other hand, I would say that they've made up for it by referring me a lifetime supply of marijuana defendants that have helped me keep my practice alive, and also a lifetime supply of free dope. So I figure I've broken even with them by now.
I only have one more question, which is, how'd you get the name Buck?
Nobody knows.
It's just been with you since you were a kid?
There are two theories, and I don't remember. Theoretically, when I was real young, like two or three, my father used to throw me in the air and catch me and call me Buckshot. And it might have started there when I was in the second and third grade. People still played marbles, and I was the best. And in that little part of Virginia where I lived at that time, if you won somebody's marbles, you were said to have bunked them. And I won so much that they called me Bunky. And then it stuck. I never got rid of it. My second wife thought that I had sold my birthright for a mess of pottage and wanted me to be called Hugh and join the Harvard Law School Association and get tailored suits from the international tailors over in Canada. And I went along with it, you know. But it made all my friends totally weird, you know. They didn't, you know, Bahu Hugh, you know, whatever. And then I've given up. It's embarrassing to grow old with a juvenile nickname, but there's nothing I can do about it. And the Free Press has long since, you know, adopted the style Hugh Perrin Buck Davis. And if you Google me, that's what you get. So I can't do anything about it.
To learn more about Buck Davis, go to freeingjohnsinclair.org.
AADL Talks to Buck Davis has been a production of the Ann Arbor District Library.